We are going to go a little out of order from our agenda today. We're going to start with opening a public hearing on House Bill 2147 and House Bill 2148. We've got the same witness list signed up for both, so Council, would you please give us a rundown on those bills?
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. House Bill 2147 and 2148 both are products of the Governor's Underage Drinking Task Force. Starting with House Bill 2147, under present ORS 809.260, a court must suspend the driving privileges of juveniles between ages 13 and 17 who are convicted of offenses involving controlled substances, such as manufacture, delivery, or possession. House Bill 2147 amends ORS 809.260 by increasing the age range from ages 13 to 17 to ages 13 to 20. That's 2147. House Bill 2148, again, is a product of the Underage Drinking Task Force. Under existing ORS 471.430, it's a Class B violation for underage persons to purchase or possess alcohol or to enter or attempt to enter licensed premises, bars, or certain clubs. There is presently no difference in the penalty for an underage person in possession of alcohol at a house party compared to an underage person in possession of alcohol while driving a vehicle. Both are Class B violations. House Bill 2148 expands ORS 471.430 and makes it a Class A violation for underage persons to possess alcohol while driving a motor vehicle.
Okay, well, we are very honored today to have our First Lady here signed up as our first witness, and I believe this may be the first appearance by our Attorney General at this committee, maybe the second. Second, okay. Anyway, Mary Oberst and Hardy Myers are our first witnesses. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. I appreciate your giving me the opportunity to testify about these first two bills in a package relating to underage drinking, and I also really appreciate your kindness in letting me go first to accommodate my schedule. I want to set the stage for you.
Can you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. Mary Oberst, First Lady of Oregon. I want to set the stage for you about the scope of the problem of underage drinking in Oregon. According to studies conducted by the Oregon Partnership, underage drinking in Oregon is significantly higher than the national average. Over half of Oregon's 14-year-olds, by the time they've reached the eighth grade, report having consumed a drink of alcohol. Almost a third of those kids report having consumed alcohol on one or more occasions in the last month. By the time they've reached the 11th grade, almost half of Oregon's kids report drinking on one or more occasions within a month, and almost a third had engaged in binge drinking, that is, drinking five or more drinks in a row. In a 2005 statewide survey of middle school and high school kids, 59% of 8th graders and 81% of 11th graders felt that alcohol was, quote, fairly easy or, quote, very easy to obtain. These statistics are alarmingly high. The task force, the Attorney General's task force, found that some of the reasons that kids drink include the willingness of friends and family to supply alcohol in private settings, the lack of consequences that adults face when they supply alcohol to kids, the ease with which minors can successfully use false identification, and the ease with which minors can purchase alcohol without identification. The recommendations of the Attorney General's Underage Drinking Task Force and the package of bills from that task force address these reasons. Attorney General Myers is going to talk to you a little bit about the scope of work of that task force, and then Phil Schradl of the Attorney General's Office and Pam Erickson of the Oregon Partnership will testify about the specifics of House Bill 2147 and 2148. Thank you again for letting me speak with you.
And thank you for your testimony. It looks like you had something prepared. Would it be possible to provide copies of that for our committee record?
Sure.
Thank you.
It's just on scratch paper.
Well, it was very well done.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you. Mr. Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, for the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and I appreciate the opportunity to offer just a few comments, further comments about the task force itself from which these measures and a number of others emerged. As the result of work done by the Leadership for Alcohol-Free Kids, which is a consortium of both private organization and governmental entities, a number of recommendations were made to Governor Kulongoski, one of which was that he asked me to form a task force to address the enforcement and adjudication of liquor laws in Oregon. This, again, in the context of recommendations dealing with underage drinking. And I was, of course, very pleased to act on that request. And the ensuing Attorney General's Underage Drinking Task Force was composed of 37 members representing a broad range of interests affected by underage drinking issues. And First Lady Mary Oberst was a very active member of that task force in her own right. And the range of interests represented included local and state law enforcement, juvenile departments, the justice system, OLCC, DMV, education, treatment, and service providers, industry representatives, and two members of the legislature. And the task force met monthly during 2006 with a goal of having a report and legislative proposals for this regular session. They divided into subgroups to discuss and examine the current status of Oregon's alcohol statutes and any needed amendments. And by July, the task force had reached consensus on a number of issues and had supported issuance of a final report with a number of recommended legislative measures. I supported the introduction of all of those measures at the recommendation of the task force, and they were introduced at my request on behalf of the task force. The two measures you're hearing today are the first two of the total measures that have cleared the House. It's my very sincere hope, Madam Chair and members, that the committee will act favorably on the measures of the task force that come to it, beginning with these today. And I'd also like to again extend my appreciation to the First Lady and to the other members of the task force for their hard work. I also should mention that Phil Schradl, my special counsel, at my request, chaired the task force, and he will be testifying momentarily about the two bills. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Comments? Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, now we have signed up Phil Schradl and Pam Erickson.
Not yet. We're start out with these.
Oh, you didn't do these first.
Okay.
Welcome to
the committee. Philip Schradl, Special Counsel to the Attorney General. Thank you very much for setting these bills. I've provided written testimony on both of the bills, House Bill 2147 and House Bill 2148. I've also provided a couple of fact sheets of information that basically provide the background information for the First Lady's comments and Attorney General Hardy Myers' comments. I've also provided in advance, I hope you have it or will receive it in the near future, the Attorney General's Underage Drinking Task Force report in its entirety. And I supplemented and inserted into that the House bills at the time that the task force report was issued. The legislation was only in Legislative Council draft form. And the two bills that are up before you today are two of the kind of, I would describe them as two of the smaller proposals out of the task force. The task force, when we reviewed the Oregon statutes, we did undertook a review of all existing statutory provisions that we thought were applicable, and then also tried to address proposals that we might suggest to you in a more global sense. Our review of the existing statutes show that Oregon is pretty good in terms of statutory provisions that currently exist. We will be coming forward with about 8 proposals that would be small changes to the existing statutes. But one of the questions and concerns that was there for us as we were reviewing these statutes is while the statutes in their current existence seem fairly good, the enforcement is rather sporadic or across the state. I think that's primarily driven by resource allocation issues, and that so one of the underlying concerns for the task force was to present proposals that would help in terms of swift and sure consequences. One of the current themes or constant themes that we heard was that the best way of getting teens' attention is to have swift and sure consequences. The two bills that are before you today are part of that underlying effort to just help improve the current existing statutes. House Bill 2147 would expand the age range of the statute 809-260. Currently, 809-260 applies only to persons who are 17 years of age or younger, not younger than 13, so from age 13 to 17. And we would propose that statutory provision be expanded to include 18, 19, and 20-year-olds. And it would provide that somebody who is convicted of an offense involving the delivery, manufacture, or possession of a controlled substance or possession, use, or abuse of alcohol would be subject to a driver's license suspension. And this, I think it was an anomaly when the statute was first enacted that it didn't cover 18, 19, and 20-year-olds. And this provision would simply expand the age range to include those persons and would have the same kind of time period for driver's license suspensions be applicable to those persons. And I would be happy to answer questions about that one or move on to address House Bill 2148 and answer any questions that you might have about either of the bills, however you would like to.
Why don't we see if there are questions on 2147?
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Well, first, I mean, the statute as written only deals with juveniles, and the proposed amendment takes it into the adult world. So it seems to me like you are now setting up a process, and if we get away from alcohol for a second, but the statute also deals with delivery, manufacture, possession of controlled substances, which are, I'm assuming, include things other than alcohol. So we're setting up a process where an adult convicted of delivery, manufacture, or possession of a controlled substance is going to get a more harsh penalty than another adult simply because they're one day younger, potentially. I don't know that's been thought of in the non-alcohol scheme of this, but that seems like there is could be an issue there.
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, the focus of the task force obviously was on alcohol use and abuse by underage drinkers. I don't know that needs to be a significant concern because it would seem to me that the same principle that drives why it would be an appropriate sanction for somebody underage who uses alcohol, that even though all use of controlled substances is unlawful, that I think the same driving principles behind that would apply in that circumstance as well, even though they were 18, 19, or 20. I think your question raises a further question about whether there might be a need to look at those over 21, whether they might also be subjected to a similar kind of penalty.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess my point, it seems there may be, and I don't know what the correct terminology is, but there's a due process, there's an unequal treatment or something. If you're treating an someone for doing something illegal just because their age different, they're both adults, and they're doing the same crime, but you're treating one differently than another, it seems to me that there's an issue there.
Chair Burdick, if I might respond. Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, I think a number of statutes draw distinctions between those who are adults and those who are minors or those who are subject to the juvenile court jurisdiction, and penalties would apply differently to those people. I think you're correct that there might be you know, an abstract question, but I don't think it rises to the level of a constitutional concern. I think it's more a question of a principle of whether you think it's appropriate or not.
Is it? Could you draw a distinction between, and I see where Senator Barr is going, between denial of a privilege and a penalty? I mean, isn't the license suspension more a retraction of a privilege rather than a penalty?
Chair Burdick, that's absolutely correct. And, in fact, we already have in place the implied consent statutes, for example, that you know, subject yourself to the withdrawal of the driving privilege, even if you simply fail to refuse or you refuse to submit yourself to a breathalyzer exam, for example. And that's on the basis that it's a driving privilege rather than the equivalent of something like a property right or something like that.
And that of course, is based on behavior. This is based on age. Can you think of other things that are based on age? That would have, some kind of an added-on denial of a privilege.
Chair Burdick, I know that people who commit offenses that, if they were adults, would subject themselves to the jurisdiction of the criminal court proceedings, can be found to have committed an offense in the juvenile court system that may well generate a supervisory or actually a treatment requirement that extends beyond the time period that they otherwise would be subject to under a criminal penalty that would be imposed if they were an adult. Mm-hmm. So there are distinctions out there and differences between, simply based on age of the individual.
That's in reverse. Yes. For juveniles. Senator Barr, does any of that get to your concern?
Well, no, it doesn't. I still think that there's an issue. And you can treat people differently with alcohol. I understand that because you're not allowed to possess alcohol until you're 21 years old. But anyone having possession of a controlled substance, they're breaking the law. So if you're treating people differently for breaking the same law simply because of their age, it seems like there should be an equal protection issue there. And if there isn't, I don't know why there isn't. And it's a sanction for breaking a law. And it just seems, and counsel said he'll answer my question.
Senator Beyer, thank you. Right now in Oregon, the law is regardless of age for manufacture, delivery, or possession of controlled substances, a driver's license suspension is supposed to be part of the penalty unless extenuating circumstances are found. That is something my understanding is that the feds required states to do in exchange for the receipt of federal money. And so Oregon adopted that sort of Oregon has those laws presently on the books regardless of your age. So if you are a controlled substance offense, license suspension is supposed to happen unless specific findings are made. That's not this statute. This statute is more age specific exactly, but the counterpart, I guess I would say, exists for persons over 21 as well with the controlled substances. If that's helpful.
So if it exists for adults under existing statute, does that mean that young people now, younger people, have a different process, or they're subject to the same suspension?
Chair Burdick, if I as a prosecutor would have an 18, 19, 20-year-old defendant, the same rule about automatic suspension for controlled substances would apply. I would say that existing ORS 809.280 is somewhat superfluous on that point because there's another statute that controls.
Well, what about 16 and 17-year-olds?
Those offenses would not be tried in adult court. So the statute for the controlled substance offenses would, for 16 and 17-year-olds, would not be tried in adult court. And my understanding, I haven't looked at the law in a while, but my understanding is the automatic license suspension wouldn't apply in that case necessarily.
So you could argue that this bill, even though it applies to a bigger age group, that the only thing new this bill would do would be to extend that suspension authority to 16 and 17-year-olds.
It's already there.
Well, 18.
It's already there under the statute.
Chair Burdick, I think it would extend it to 18, 19, 20-year-olds.
Right. I know that's what this bill does, but if I'm understanding counsel correctly, other laws also already apply this suspension to 18, 19, and 20-year-olds because they're over 18 and they're not in juvenile court.
For controlled substances.
For controlled substances. Right. I'm only talking controlled substances. So right now, as I understand you, the controlled substances piece of this does apply to if you're over 18, but does not apply if you're under juvenile court jurisdiction, 16 and 17. Is that correct?
Yes, I see your point. Right.
So,
but it does, this law in the current.
Yeah,
law.
This law. So basically, the effect of this law would be for alcohol, it would extend it to 20-year-olds. But for controlled substances, it would extend it to 16 and 17-year-olds. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Well, Chair Burdick, I think not for the 16 and 17-year-olds because the current existing statute already applies for those between 13 and 17.
For controlled substances.
We're simply changing the age to, if you accept the proposal, to go from 13 to 20.
So in the case of 18 to 20, 17 to 20-year-olds, then it's kind of redundant because it's already in effect.
Chair Burdick, I believe that's correct. Again, the focus of the task force was
for
on the underage drinking. For controlled
substances.
Substances.
But not for alcohol.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Okay.
I believe
so
that's correct.
I think that should resolve your concern, Senator Byers.
It does, but it seems to me like if that is the case, if this statute is redundant, and it probably should be rewritten.
The controlled substance language.
Yes. If the controlled substance language already exists somewhere else for 18 to 20-year-olds.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, off the top of my head, if it really is redundant, yes. It might take a little bit of time to make sure that it is actually redundant. There are different processes that might afford, depending on which statute you're proceeding under or not. Again, the goal here was to extend the time on the alcohol use, abuse, possession. It wasn't intended to address the controlled substances.
I can say one thing about this. Senator Beyer, Chair Burdick, the one thing that I would say is not redundant, to my understanding of the law, is that this would purportedly reach 16, 17-year-olds with driver's license. And my understanding of the adult law is it doesn't. So that's the only piece that isn't redundant for controlled substances.
The 16 and 17-year-old piece.
Correct.
But I guess
that's what I said before, and you said it was already in the law. So what's true here?
Madam Chair, I guess if this isn't redundant for 18 through 20-year-olds, it's a policy shift. And then I think we may have some equal protection issues or something. If it is redundant, it seems like it should be rewritten so that people know that it's somewhere else. And that's it. Just because to read this statute, you would never guess that 18 to 20-year-olds already have this affecting them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a policy shift for 18 to 20-year-olds if it isn't already someplace else.
Chair Burdick, if I might, maybe the resolution of this might be if this were redrafted in such a way that there's a second subsection that just extends the time period only with respect to alcohol.
Well, it seems like that would make sense because 16 and 17-year-olds are already covered for controlled substances under the existing underage statutes, not the controlled substance statutes, but the underage statutes. And then if the 18 to 20-year-olds are already covered for substances, illegal substances, then, yeah, that would make sense. It's just to apply this to alcohol. So maybe that sounds like a fairly simple fix.
Yeah, Chair Burdick, why don't I suggest that I work with committee counsel staffer and we see if we can't come up with language that will negate the concern that Senator Beyer has raised.
I don't sense any disagreement on the committee of the policy choice of having controlled substance violations or crimes subject to this. Do I hear any argument on that?
No, they already are.
Right.
That's what we've been told, that okay. they already are. If they're not, then that is another discussion.
Okay. Well, that's great. Any other questions, comments? Welcome. We'll hear from you, Pam, and if you do you want to add anything or?
No, I think you said all.
All right. I would like to get some. Okay. Well, then
Chair Burdick, if I might add a couple of comments about House Bill 2148, then for consideration by the committee. This would create a new subcategory of minor in possession while driving, and the thought behind the task force's proposal was that there's a very serious societal risk out there, and it's certainly a message that we don't want our teens to have, is that having possession of alcohol while driving is anything nearly appropriate. And I think there's an enhanced risk that if you have possession of alcohol while driving, that it leads into driving under the influence or driving while having consumed alcohol. And our thought was that to try and keep those activities, to the extent that they're engaged in at all, completely separate, that we thought it was appropriate to provide for an enhanced penalty for driving while in possession while driving. And it would move it simply from a Class B violation to a Class A violation, which would enhance the monetary penalty associated with that, but it wouldn't move it into a misdemeanor or anything like that. It's just an enhanced violation penalty.
So it's already a Class A violation if they're in possession outside of a car?
It's a Class B violation.
Class B
and
violation.
This would
and
create
this would enhance it to a
Class A. Yeah, enhance it to a Class A violation, with the underlying message behind that being drinking and driving is even more serious than simply possession.
Okay, now possession would be defined how? I mean, the container wouldn't have to be open.
Nope.
Correct, it would not.
Any kind of...
If you had someone that's, let's say, going out for the weekend, going camping or whatever, they're 20 years of age, and they get pulled over and they've got the stuff in the back of their car, nothing's open, they're guilty. If they are driving with an open container, as well as modern possession, MIP, and if you have someone that has drank before they left, let's say they were at home and they drank, then they got in the car and drove, right. They'd also be...
Doing.
And so three different ways.
Three different ways. So yeah. So open container would still be a separate violation.
Chair Burdick, that's correct. And this is one of those that the task force believes that time is right for some messages to be sent, because the statistical information out there is that, as the First Lady and Attorney General Myers mentioned, drinking rates by teens in Oregon are substantially higher than the national average, and we need to do something to heighten awareness of that and to have some penalties. This current system simply isn't working, and this is one of those proposals.
Let me ask a question.
Senator Pazansky.
Here's a concern I've got for 2148. Looking at subsection 1, it talks about the general prohibition for a person that's under 21 to be in possession of alcohol. And then what we're doing, we're going to enhance the penalty if they're driving. So as it's currently written, isn't it true that if someone was with their parent and they were driving the vehicle and there was alcohol in the vehicle, they could in fact be cited and charged with the Class A violation, because the person driving the vehicle is the minor and there is alcohol in the car, and under Oregon law, the person driving the car has control or is considered to have control over what's in the vehicle?
Chair Burdick, Senator Pazansky, well, I think that concern might exist in the statute already, whether or not it's enhanced to a Class A violation or not. I think as a matter of prosecutorial choice, that I don't think that kind of a charge would ever be brought. There is provision already existing in statute that parents, for example, can actually provide alcohol to underage children, and if they're in control of the premises, and I think it would be viewed as a joint controller of the vehicle, although I suppose that somebody could creatively already under the existing statute make the argument that you are presenting. I'm unaware of any prosecution ever being brought. Prosecution might be the wrong term there, but any charge of a violation brought under that existing statute on those fact circumstances.
Well, but there's also the case of you know, the 20-year-old driving and the 21-year-old as the passenger who says they're the owner of the alcohol. I mean, you know, where do we draw the line? It seems to me that you might want to make some kind of an exclusion that parallels existing law about parents being able to provide their kids, because you don't want to protect the 20-year-old who's got a 21-year-old car in the car with them and, you know, a whole bunch of beer in the back.
Chair Burdick, that question also exists under the current existing statute, I think. And, you know, that fact scenario, though, I think raises a little bit more of alarm bells in my head, because the statistical information that we provided to you shows that one of the primary sources of alcohol for underage drinkers are people who are 21 or older providing it to them. And that fact pattern that you just described is susceptible of at least two, if not more, potential background pieces that led to it. It could be that the intent behind that event was solely for overage drinkers to drink, and the underage person in the vehicle was never going to have access to the alcohol. It could also be a scenario where the 21-year-old is providing alcohol to the underage drinker. And I don't think that this issue of joint possession in the car should necessarily at all drive the determination about whether you think somebody who has violated the statute should be suffer an enhanced penalty of a Class A violation or not. It seems like more of the questions are going to questions about how the current statute or the changed statute, if the amendment is adopted, should be applied.
No, and I understand. We just try to be as clear as we can. The other scenario, conversely, could be the 21-year-old driving and the 20-year-old is traveling with him.
Right, you know, correct. So. Well, that's correct.
Yeah.
Sure.
Senator Barr.
Thank you. Not knowing this off the top of my head, could counsel explain to us the difference between a Class A and a Class B violation?
Senator Barr, thank you. Class A, $720 maximum fine. Class B, $360 maximum fine.
Quite a difference.
Yep.
Double. We have been joined by our governor, if he would like to say a few words or whether he just came to visit. We are a family-friendly judiciary committee. Welcome, Governor.
Yes.
But I just want to be clear on this before we, I don't know if you're ready to move on or not, but I think I've learned something today. What you said is that if a 20-year-old, under current law, a 20-year-old is driving a vehicle with, whether it be parents or anyone else over the age of 21, and there's alcohol in that vehicle, the 20-year-old can be charged under the statute.
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, I believe Senator Przanski has raised a valid question. As I said before, I'm unaware of anybody ever having been charged with
such. I didn't ask if they ever had been.
No.
But it's possible they could be.
I think logically it is possible that someone could be. I think the counter to that obviously would be that the parents actually are in control of the alcohol in the vehicle.
I didn't say parents. I said anyone over the age of 21.
Oh, anyone over the age of 21, yes.
Please refresh my memory. The existing statutes, if a parent allows a child to drink alcohol, there's an exclusion, like for, you know, to have wine at a religious ceremony or something like that. Does that exemption apply to anyone over 21 or just family members, or how does that work?
Chair Burdick, it's my recollection that the statute only provides that exemption for parents serving to their own minor children. Mm-hmm. And it provides an exemption for, you can provide alcohol to your minor children unless they're impaired to a noticeable degree.
So it would seem to me that to clear this up, at a minimum, you'd want an exemption here for the case where a minor was driving the car with their parents and there was alcohol in the car. I mean, it seems at a minimum you'd want to exempt that.
Chair Burdick, you might make that choice, yes. It would be a clarification of, I think, what the current, how the current statute is already implemented, but you could do that, yes.
Yeah. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that statute, though, says that the exemption is if you provide alcohol in your home. Mm-hmm. It's not outside the home.
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, I believe that's correct.
Right.
Yeah. I believe that's true, too.
I didn't want to get in trouble for giving my kids a glass of wine at a holiday or something like that, and that is the statute.
Yeah. But, yeah. And, again, you know, this applies to the existing statute with the lower fine as well as an issue. If you're teaching your kid to drive and you got a bottle of wine in the trunk or something.
Chair Burdick, again, you know, I think that both law enforcement and then the prosecutorial arm would not want to go down that road of starting to bring charges on those instances. I think the matters of proof would be terrific to overcome. I think you would have, you know, the adult who is in the car be, you know, professing that they were in control of the alcohol and that there was, you know, an absolute bar on the underage person from having access to it. Similar to having alcohol in your home. I mean, if you have an underage person in your home, I mean, there isn't a statute that, you know, makes that a violation. But, you know, so I think this may be a problem that really doesn't exist. But you certainly could consider clarifying a statute if you wish.
Yeah, I think probably it's not worth it because, you know, all we're doing here is really raising the fine, not changing the structure of it.
Yes, Chair Burdick,
that was our discussion, however.
Yes.
Are there other questions from the committee?
Question. These other bills, since you made reference to what was in the task force, we actually have that, and we actually have the copies. Can you tell us, give us a status as to the current status as to where 2144, which is expands the crime of endangering the welfare of a minor, to include allowing a minor to remain in the presence of a legal alcohol-related activity?
Certainly.
And then the other one is 2145, which is the one that prohibits parents or guardians from providing alcohol beverages to parents or guardians, minor, child, or ward if the child or ward is impaired to a noticeable degree.
Certainly. Chair Burdick, Senator Przanski, with respect to House Bills 2144 and 2146, there were questions that were raised by a representative from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'm currently working with her to see if we can't resolve any differences that there might be with respect to those two bills. They were heard. They have not come back before the House Judiciary Committee for a work session to date. With respect to House Bill 2145, there was a question raised by a member or two of the House Judiciary Committee along the lines of the, does it have any effect upon the religious exemption or the provision to, and should that be moved, and should there be a different kind of language than what the task force suggested. House Bills 2149 and House Bill 2150 have passed out of the House Judiciary Committee and are awaiting a floor vote. The only bill to date that has not passed through the committee is House Bill 2151, and that has to do with moving from a knowing standard to a new or should have known standard. The rest of those bills were very helpful. We'll be making their way to the Senate side in the near future.
I believe it's 2152.
There's both of them. There's 2151 and 2152.
Right. And House Bill 2152 is really the primary bill that came out of the task force, and that would move to an administrative license suspension proposal that would complement the existing procedures. And the goal behind that proposal is to effectuate the swift and sure consequences that we really anticipate would have the most effect as a deterrent matter on underage drinking. As I said, this current state of the statutory provisions in the Oregon are actually, they're fairly strong. The difficulty, I think, is that trigger those entails exercising the judicial system, and there are lots of costs associated with that. And as a resource matter, they are sporadically enforced around the state. The goal behind House Bill 2152 is to make a cost-effective administrative process that would lead to license suspensions.
Thank you for that rundown. Are there other questions from the committee? Okay, we're going to close. Pam, did you want to add anything?
Well, I just
can you identify yourself if you can?
My name is Pamela Erickson. I'm deputy director of the Oregon Partnership,
And I just wanted to add a few more comments about the seriousness of this problem. I've provided you some colorful slides that you can look at your leisure. But just to emphasize the seriousness of this problem, we at Oregon Partnership work with youth a lot, and we ask them about their environment, and they're very forthcoming about the party scene that they experience. And what they tell us is really pretty scary. I don't know whether you've heard, but girls are now drinking at rates much, much higher than boys, even in the eighth grade. Another thing that we've never seen happen is that adult males and young girls party together pretty commonly. And oftentimes they're the ones that are supplying the alcohol and sometimes drugs. So we think that the party scene today is very dangerous, and kids are able to organize a party within an hour. Parties don't happen by sending out invitations anymore. They just happen.
Text message.
Text message, you bet. It's really fast. And kids often party in places where they're both drugs and alcohol. So we really need to get a handle on this issue before it just overwhelms us. So we really appreciate your attention and want you to understand some of the seriousness of the problem. Thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you very much. Any questions, comments from the committee? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2147 and 2148. And I would like to open a work session on House Bill 2148. Are you comfortable with that, Senator Krasanski?
Sure.
Okay, open a work session on House Bill 2148, Senator Krasanski.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2148 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Krasanski has moved House Bill 2148 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. So we will work on amendments to House Bill 2147 to make it more alcohol specific and just so to clarify it. And nice work, task force. Thank you very much. Okay, we will now open a. Pardon? Oh, Senator Brzezinski will carry that.
I'll carry it.
Senator Brzezinski will carry it. Okay. Now we're going to open another public hearing on Senate Bill 3. Oh, let's see, wait a second. Which one has most people? Okay. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 629. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. Senate Bill 629 relates to money judgments against persons in custody. ORS 137.183 provides that money judgments in criminal actions accrue interest at the rate of 12.5% annually for the first 5 years from the date the judgment is entered, and then at 4% each subsequent year. It is presently irrelevant whether a defendant is sentenced to prison. The same rules apply. Senate Bill 629 amends ORS 137.183 to provide that interest does not accrue on any money judgment while the defendant is incarcerated. Once the defendant is released, then the same rules would apply. 12.5% for the first 5 years, and then 4% interest for each subsequent year. Senate Bill 629 applies only to judgments entered after July 1, 2007, which would also be the effective date of the Act.
Okay, Senator Walker, this is your bill, so welcome to the committee on that side of the deal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to get through this without hacking too much. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. This is one of two bills I introduced this session to assist inmates upon reentry into society. This bill came up at a meeting I was at in Eugene, sponsored by the Partnership for Safety and Justice, and David Rogers will be testifying, and he'll present you with this booklet, which is just phenomenal. And it talks about some of the barriers to reentry for inmates. As you know, our prison system is overflowing, and there are several barriers for inmates on reentering society, which often brings them back into the system. So the recidivism rate is pretty high, and it's my intent, as well as I think all of us here, that we try to make that transition much easier so that we don't have them come back into the penal system. So this bill came up because someone brought it to my attention that when inmates go to off to prison, then interest begins to accrue on their fines and any judgments, and they can be quite high. And if you are sentenced to prison for a long period of time, that interest accrues for a very long period of time, so that when you are discharged back out on parole, you're faced with trying to pay off this judgment, which is really rather high. And as an example, Madam Chair, I did some quick research, and the average salary for an inmate is 28 cents. They make 28 cents an hour to $1.15 an hour. It's about a dollar a day. From that, they must purchase their toiletries and incidentals and send any money home if they have anyone at home that they need to send money home to. If they work in the prison industries program, they do make a little bit more. They actually make prevailing wage because there's a federal law that requires that we pay prevailing wage. But then the corrections department takes 80% of that salary to help pay for administration of the program. Those inmates tend to make $100 to $200, no more than $200 a month. Nancy Sellers with the Department of Corrections indicates there are fewer than 200 of the 13,000 inmates who work for the Oregon Corrections Enterprise Program who do get an hourly wage. So this bill is an attempt to give these people a leg up when they get out. It would begin entry of the judgment, the interest paying on the judgment as soon as they are discharged, and for the first 5 years it would be 12.5% and thereafter 4% per annum. We passed a bill, I believe in 99, about judgments and criminal actions, and there actually is a current House bill right now that is working on some implementation issues of that, and that set up this interest rate. So this interest rate is what we presently are going to be charging. I just simply want to suspend it during the time of incarceration. And you will see another bill that I have about arrest records, and I was going to introduce one other bill, but I didn't need to do that because there are other conversations in the building about reentry issues for inmates. So, Madam Chair, that's why I've introduced it today.
Thank you, Senator Walker. You can rejoin us if you like, unless committee members have questions.
Okay.
Thank you. We'll call Amy Alconich, David Rogers, and Arwin Byrd.
Okay, well, I'll start while David is handing out his the information. My name is Arwin Byrd. I'm a member of Crime Survivors for Community Safety, which is a program of the Partnership for Safety and Justice. It was 14 years ago today that my sister and I were rear-ended in a crash caused by a man who'd had too much to drink and then chose to drive. The crash paralyzed me and gave my sister a mild traumatic brain injury. I'm ever so grateful to be here with you today. It feels very right and fitting for me to choose to testify at this hearing in support of Senate Bill 629 as part of a way of honoring this anniversary for me. The man who hit us was convicted of DUI and assault and was ordered to pay restitution to my sister and me. My personal experience with the restitution owed to us inspires quite a bit of passion in me about the subject in general. Our society should be doing much, much more to help crime survivors heal after trauma and violence. This includes getting restitution to people who have been harmed. Our criminal justice system should be doing much more to foster a sense of accountability in people who have hurt us. I'm here to support Senate Bill 629 and the thinking behind this bill as a move in the direction of creating a system that helps survivors heal through restitution and supports accountability for the people who have hurt us. My sister and I are not getting the restitution that is owed to us. I have had 14 years to wade through various layers of government trying to get assistance for this, and what I am left with is the firm belief that it's the system's focus on punishment over the value of accountability that has prevented this from happening. There was assistance for my sister and I during the trial and sentencing for the man who hit us, during the punishment phase. But now that his punishment is over, there is little available for my sister and I to deal with the lifelong harm that we experience. Our current criminal justice system is so focused on punishing the person convicted of crime that healing for survivors and the notion of accountability for that healing process gets lost. Under Senate Bill 629, the period of time when interest begins accruing on restitution orders would change. This change also represents a shift to a system of accountability. Currently, interest accrues on restitution orders while people are incarcerated, while they have been removed from society without access to living wage jobs as part of their sentence. Essentially, the restitution debt becomes part of their punishment, compounding interest with little tie to the actual significance of the way restitution represents harm to crime survivors. The debt grows and grows, and the convicted person's ability to pay that debt back to the people they hurt diminishes in equal amount. Although I am here today talking about compounding interest, what's really happening under our current system is compounding harm. That's punishment, and it doesn't do anything to help survivors or develop a sense of accountability in the people who hurt us. The proposed change is a way of bringing in greater amounts of accountability into our system. Under this proposed change, interest would begin accruing once a person was released from prison. As a person who is still owed restitution, I want for our system to prioritize helping survivors get restitution that is owed to them. Part of that is understanding what changes need to be made to help the person who owes restitution succeed in paying it. It may seem counterintuitive for someone who has owed restitution to ask for a change that would delay the interest on that debt, but I firmly believe that this change will actually do more to help survivors get restitution in the long run. Accountability is about repairing harm. I want to create a criminal justice system that is focused on that goal and willing to make changes that are most likely to achieve it. The crash that paralyzed me has inspired me to a life's work based in preventing what happened to me from happening again, and also preventing violence in general. I want a criminal justice system that prioritizes helping survivors heal after they've been victimized. And I want a system that helps people who have caused harm succeed at repairing the harm through accountability. I would like to invite you to join me in helping to create such a criminal justice system by passing this bill, Senate Bill 629. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Mr. Rogers, are you next?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is David Rogers, and I'm the Executive Director of Partnership for Safety and Justice. We're a statewide advocacy organization that works to create safe and sensible solutions around public safety problems and issues. And we're unique in the fact that we actually bring together the folks who are most actually impacted by the criminal justice system. We think it's a very important strategy, and it gives us a holistic perspective on the types of system change that is really needed. I'm here to strongly advocate in support of Senate Bill 629. We think it strikes an appropriate balance in terms of court sentencing associated fees and fines, and we also think that this bill will help reduce recidivism. It's not unusual for someone to have tens of thousands of dollars of court associated fees, fines, and restitution debt to pay back just after spending a few years incarcerated on, for example, a burglary charge. And also nationally, there's evidence that suggests that two-thirds of jail inmates report an income of less than $12,000 prior to their incarceration. So really the point being that the far majority of people who are incarcerated are low income to begin with, and their chances of meaningful employment afterwards are even less than before they're incarcerated. In the interest of reducing recidivism, it's critical to assess whether the implementation of court-associated financial obligations can, in fact, contribute to someone's failure when they reenter society. And I know that these issues aren't black and white. Restitution, for example, it's a critical part of supporting crime victims and supporting accountability for the offender. At the same time, charging interest while people are incapacitated is a good place to draw the line. Interests can, in fact, be an important incentive for people to quickly pay off those obligations when they're able to. But that incentive is lost when it begins while people are, in fact, incapacitated and can't do anything to pay off those fines and fees. It's worth noting that in the fall of 2006, we released a report called Access Denied in Oregon, a report on the barriers faced by people with a past felony conviction. I've given you all a copy of that. We thought it was important to look at addressing the areas of breaking the cycle of recidivism and examine the types of barriers that people with a past felony conviction actually experience in Oregon. We used a number of different research methods, and among those, we surveyed over 384 people, Oregonians, with a past felony conviction. What we found was that there are a range of barriers. In fact, paying off court fees and fines rises to the top of some of the barriers they experience. That being said, we think that it's important to look at the collateral consequences and examine that there are small changes that can be made that really help people succeed once they're released. And it's also worth noting that in the past 10 years, Oregon's prison system has doubled, and the prison system budget has practically tripled. And our very own director of Department of Corrections, Max Williams, suggests that we are on an unsustainable trajectory in terms of the growth of the prison system. That being the case, I think that I really encourage legislators to think long and hard about the small changes that they can make to actually break that cycle of recidivism and figure out ways that we can encourage people's success once they reenter the community. Because a lot's at stake, and in fact, it's also a great cost to taxpayers. When people fail and actually reenter the system. So that being said, we think that this bill is fair, it makes sense, and if we want people to succeed, we really have to set measurable, achievable benchmarks for their success. And in that respect, actually not accruing interest while people clearly are not in a position to pay is a step in the right direction. I also want to submit written testimony that was given to me by Ron Chase, who is the executive director of Sponsors, Inc., which is an over 30-year-old nonprofit organization based in Lane County that has worked on supporting people successfully reentering the community from prison and jail. And he also has supportive words for Senate Bill 629.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I should wait, but in the cases where people do have the ability to pay, obviously this will, I mean, it becomes an interest-free loan for the time they're incarcerated, and, you know, specifically if there's white-collar crime, wealthy people, or in the case of an automobile accident, some people, you know, they get in automobile accidents, they hit people, they, you know, get convicted, and this bill will give them, in a sense, an interest-free loan, and they may have lots of money to pay it. Is there any thoughts on that issue?
Well, I would just suggest that this bill doesn't prevent people who have the ability to pay while they are incarcerated to begin paying off court-associated fees and fines. It merely just suggests that interest shouldn't be accrued. And my sense is that the number of people who have the ability to pay are few and far between when you really look at who's incarcerated in the state's prison system.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand it doesn't prevent them, but if they have no incentive by no interest accruing or the debt not growing, the people would never pay it early, I would not think.
I have a thought. Just, you know, as a survivor of violence, I would like to see more. Excuse me, Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer. I would like to see more being done to help engender a sense of accountability and actually that our system would work more cohesively to connect the violence that and the choices that an individual made that caused harm in somebody else's life. And I don't think that whether or not, and I think interest is certainly an incentive, but I think that there's much, much more that our criminal justice system could be doing just in terms of the ways that the folks that are employed within prison systems or parole and probation officers. Well, obviously, if somebody's in contact with a parole officer, then they're on the outside. But the culture that exists inside the prison could be one that actually helps people recognize the harm that was done and help them make better choices in their life. And I don't think that whether or not interest is accruing is actually going to help that shift.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, if I may, I think the issue...
Can you identify yourself?
I'm sorry. Amy Alconich, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and Madam Chair, Senator Beyer. In response to that question, I believe it could be solved through some sort of court order that if you have an individual who has the ability to pay, and the court can recognize that at the time of sentencing, can enter either a requirement for a lump payment up front so the victim can be made whole immediately, or the court can say, while in custody, defendant inmate must pay X amount every month towards restitution or a compensatory fine, which is, I think, probably actually more appropriate way to compensate the victim. But so I do believe that situation can be addressed through that court order and may result in even additional payments being made right up front. I think when you have the situation of somebody who has access to that funds, that's something all the parties know about up front and can be negotiated into either a plea agreement or ordered by the judge at sentencing after trial.
Question, Madam Chair. Well, and you know obviously more about this than I do, but it seems to me that if you have a statute that says that interest won't accrue and no payments have to be made, if the judge was to do that, that would be an enhanced sentence, and that would have to probably be pled to a jury, wouldn't it?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, my understanding is that restitution is not a sentence enhancement factor. There is a list of sentence enhancement factors, and none of those, I think maybe what you're thinking of is maybe greater harm than average, which is what I could maybe apply to that. But I think it's not a sentence enhancement factor. It's simply the amount owed as a result of the commission of the crime and what would be required to make the victim whole. So I don't think it would need to be pled and proven to a jury, with the exception of when it's an element in the basic statutory language of the crime. So, for instance, an aggravated theft would be $10,000, and during trial, the district attorney would need to both plead and prove that, but it's not a sentence enhancement factor.
I'm not sure you were there that day, but we actually attended the Court of Appeals hearing on whether restitution is an enhancement factor. And then when the court later ruled, it ruled indeed that restitution was not a Blakely affected enhancement factor. We were actually there that day.
Also, Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, whoo-wee. Suddenly getting really flush and sick. The question you asked, Senator Beyer, was that they would stop making payments. This bill doesn't tell them the payments stop. It just says the interest stops. The payments continue. If you're ordered to pay restitution while you're in prison because you have the money to do so, you still have to do that. It's simply that the interest stops, which can be compounded pretty significantly if it's a large fine and you're in prison for a long period of time.
And I understand that, but it just seems to me that if someone has money and they're going to get sent to prison for 5 years and there's going to be no interest on it, there's no incentive to pay that. But anyone knows the compounding factor in 5 years at 12.5% interest, judgment doubles. So if someone has the ability to pay a lump sum up front, this compounding interest while they're in prison will be a huge incentive for them to do it.
But the judge can order them to pay it if they have it, is what I'm hearing here. And that's not affected by the bill one way or the other, right?
I don't believe so, Madam Chair, though if Senator Beyer feels we need to, we can always put in a provision in here that says unless the court determines the inmate has the ability to pay. But then that puts the court in the position of having to determine that.
The court already has that duty. They have to do that at the time of that judgment.
That's what I thought.
Okay. All right. Other questions?
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. Okay, we
I
have.
I think Amy finished. Amy testified.
Oh, that's right. You just answered a question. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and I'll try and keep this brief since I think all the points have been addressed. For us, this is a matter of fundamental fairness, that when somebody is incarcerated, they do not have the ability to pay necessarily the compounding interest. It puts them in an insurmountable position after release. This doesn't affect, in our reading of this, the ability and requirement of the court to order how restitution can be paid right up front or how much it should be paid while they're in custody. It simply prevents the unfair amount of interest being accrued while they are in custody. We support it. We think it's fair. I don't want to go on too long since I know there are other bills. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members,
thank you very much. Other questions? Thank you. Okay. Cheryl Stone and Paul Snyder.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and with me is Cheryl Stone from the Oregon Judicial Department. Our association has not taken a position on Senate Bill 629, and we have no dispute with the underlying goals behind it. I'm appearing today for two purposes, one of which is to alert the committee to other legislation, and the second is to clarify a provision of the bill. The first purpose I think Senator Walker has already alluded to, and that's the existence of House Bill 2311. That bill is in the House Judiciary Committee right now, and that would affect the calculation of interest, and it would potentially provide other reasons for waiver of interest, which are more administrative in nature. And I don't want to divert the committee's attention away from this bill to talk about that one, just to tell you that it exists, and if both bills pass, there would have to be some reconciliation. And I think that can be accomplished without affecting the goals behind Senate Bill 629. The purpose for clarification of the bill has to do with the new paragraph A in ORS 137-183, sub 1. That would be a question. The way I first read the bill, it seemed to me that the purpose of it was to suspend the interest on a judgment for the underlying charge for that particular offense. So in other words, if a circuit judge sentences an individual to 3 years in prison and that is followed by a period of supervision, post-prison supervision, that the interest would be suspended for that three-year period. And it would apply as to only that particular charge. So in other words, if in the case of a witness in a previous panel, it sounds like there's been an outstanding judgment for years and years. And as to that particular scenario, it would seem that the person's initial incarceration would be an appropriate time to suspend the imposition of the interest. And here are some of the problems that might come up otherwise. People go in and out of prison, in and out of jail. Some people do it rather frequently. The way we have our parole and probation system set up, there is something called a level 3 sanctions, which is to say that a community corrections department has the authority for somebody who's under post-prison supervision or who's on probation to place that person in jail for a limited period of time without going through the court. It works well on a lot of levels. It saves the court time. It saves the time for appointing a defense attorney. It saves the district attorney time. And it's intended just to apply for a brief period of time. The problem I see with applying Senate Bill 629 to that situation is that there would be potentially several different places where an individual serves a short period of incarceration that the sentencing court wouldn't even know about. It could also apply, I suppose, potentially to a term of incarceration the person serves in another state or in another county. And if I'm reading the bill correctly, and if the intent is to apply just to the original sentence, the original term and the original sentence, then I think that's something that's pretty easy to calculate, because after all, this is the court that sentenced that person in the first place. And the court should pretty easily be able to find out when the person gets out again. But to apply it to other terms of incarceration, it could create some administrative difficulties that it would be hard to figure out.
Okay. Any questions? Senator Walker, do you have any comments on that?
Well, Paul talked to me about that just before the hearing, and I understand the concern they have, especially if someone goes in and out. A lot of folks go back in for parole violations, and then what do you do with the interest calculation? So I think I'd want to hear from David Rogers about that proposal. Paul, what was your suggestion? You wanted to put something in the on line 9?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Walker, I was thinking that on line 9, perhaps after the word from, insert original, and after the word custody, insert for that sentence. So it would read from the date the person is released from original custody for that sentence.
Okay. Well, I'd like to hear from Mr. Rogers in response to that, Madam Chair, if I could.
Okay, after we get done with this panel.
Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you. Welcome.
Cheryl Stone from the Oregon Judicial Department, and I am not here to testify on the bill, but just to answer any questions about how the Judicial Department will be calculating interest or not, and any questions about how that process works.
I do have a question. Would you agree with Mr. Snyder that it would create a problem if we didn't limit it to the original custody of an original sentence?
I do think there would need to, it would help us if there, I'm sorry, Senator Burdick, Senator Walker, there would be some clarification needed to know what types of incarceration that you are wanting to stay the interest on, and also if it is only for the current judgment that they're incarcerated for, or all judgments. Many defendants have several cases, and so is it your intention that they the interest stops accruing on all of those cases, or just the one?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Do you want David back?
Uh huh. Please,
Mr. Rogers, can you come back up for a minute?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, I think that the administrative challenges that Paul Snyder just spoke to seem like it would be reasonable to address that, and I think that it would certainly strengthen the bill, and I think that Amy has a slight adjustment around the proposed language to address some of the administrative barriers.
Amy O'Connor, Madam Chair, Senator Walker, members of the committee.
Can you come closer to the microphone, please? I've got
a
cold,
sorry,
and I'm all plugged up.
I apologize. I just got over it. It's terrible cold.
Yeah, it is miserable. Thank you.
My suggestion with the after original, don't remember exactly the language that he said, but
Madam Chair, he said on line 9, from the date the person is released from original custody for that sentence.
And I think you would need to clarify somewhere in that sentence that it should be that the time should start accruing after entry of judgment of conviction and upon commencement of the sentence. So the situation I'm envisioning is somebody is in custody, is released pending sentencing, or the flip is taken into custody and released at some point. I just think it needs to be very clear that the original sentence begins after the entry of a judgment of conviction and sentencing occurs, since they often occur. Sometimes it can be up to, you know, I've had 120 days pre-sentence investigation, so on. So I think that just needs to be really clear about exactly when it starts. So that would be my recommendation.
Madam Chair,
you're welcome.
I I think I'd be amenable to that. That's kind of what I wanted to hear, whether you agreed that this created a problem, as Mr. Snyder suggested. If they're in, they go back and forth. And apparently it is, but I think we can work on some language that hones that down a little bit, Madam Chair. And I don't think it'd be a problem at all to get that fixed.
Okay.
If the committee is inclined to move this bill, otherwise I'm not going to bother.
Well, speaking only for the Chair, I think it's a good concept, and I'd like to see the work done on it. And also perhaps if you could maybe check up on the other bill that was mentioned, 1144 or something, over in the House that pertains to the same subject area, and maybe get a grip on how those two fit together.
Yeah, that's House Bill 2311, Madam Chair. And
close.
I got an email from Jad Limhouse, who is a Justice of the Peace in Harrisburg, about that, and he indicates in his email that he says the two bills will at some point need to be reconciled, but they don't differ in their goals, so I think they're easily reconcilable, and I'll work on making sure that's true.
Okay, and thank you for bringing that to us.
All right,
okay,
thank you.
We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 629 and reopen the work session on House Bill 2148 for the purpose of suspending the rules so Senator Beyer can vote. Senator Walker, could you make a motion?
Oh, yes, Madam Chair.
We'd like to suspend the rules to allow Senator Beyer to vote on House Bill 2148.
I think you need
to
suspend the rules.
I think you do. Yeah, you do, and I didn't know you weren't here. I'd like to suspend, I make a motion, Madam Chair, that we suspend the rules to allow Senator Beyer to vote on House Bill 2148.
Any discussion? Any objection? Senator Beyer, how do you vote?
Vote no.
Senator Beyer votes no on House Bill 2148. The rest of the votes are the same. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2148 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 327. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. Senate Bill 327 relates to the charge of manufacture of marijuana. Under present ORS 161.570, the district attorney may treat certain felonies as Class A misdemeanors. These felonies include three different categories. One, any Class C non-person felony. Examples include possessions of Schedule II drugs, identity theft, theft in the first degree. Category 2, possession of certain Schedule I drugs. And then Category 3 is possession of over an ounce of marijuana. Senate Bill 327 adds a new felony to the list of felonies that a district attorney may treat as a misdemeanor. ORS 475.856, the unlawful manufacture of marijuana, is presently a Class A felony. In order to be eligible for misdemeanor treatment, again, the choice of which is made by the district attorney, the offense must involve the manufacture of less than 6 plants or 24 ounces of marijuana, or less than 18 marijuana seedlings. Prior to electing to treat any felony offense under this law as a misdemeanor, the district attorney is obligated to adopt written guidelines as to when and under what circumstances the selection may be made.
Okay. We have... We have signed up Leland Berger. I think it's working its way down the table. I think I'm next, and then you're next.
I'm sorry.
I have it as well.
Welcome to the committee.
It's the cred right now all over the state.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Leland Berger. I'm a lawyer. I live and work from my home in Northeast Portland in Senator Carter and Representative Shields districts. I practice statewide representing medical marijuana patients and their providers, as well as other trial-level criminal defense work, and I do appeals also. I want to thank the OCDLA requested the committee file this at my request, and I want to thank the committee for doing so, and I want to thank the chair particularly for scheduling the hearing today. I receive about 5 or 6 calls a year from people who had previously been convicted of manufacturing marijuana who were offered, let me back up half a step. There's another statute that allows the court at sentencing, independent of what the district attorney wants to do, to reduce certain offenses to misdemeanors. That statute is ORS 161705. One of the kinds of cases that can be reduced is a delivery for consideration, and it's not untypical in small personal use marijuana gardens for people to be offered as an alternative to plead guilty to this expungible offense, this delivery for consideration. And what happens is people who stand up and say, no, that's not true, I wasn't growing it to sell it to anybody, I was growing it for myself, and are willing to be held accountable for what they did, find out later in life that they are not able to expunge the offense and they're not able to obtain certain benefits, whether it's housing, work, or other kinds of problems that come up by virtue of having a prior felony conviction. So in responding to this primary injustice, there are three kinds of approaches that could be taken. One would be to amend ORS 161705 to include manufacture of a controlled substance. One would be to amend the expungement statute, 137225, I think. 1352, I forget the number for sure, but the expunction statute, the statute that allows convictions to be set aside and records of arrest to be sealed. And or this approach. And we took this approach because it empowers the prosecutor at the front end to reduce the offense to the to a misdemeanor, which impacts the system in a with a positive fiscal impact. It's cheaper both to prosecute and to process and to defend misdemeanor cases rather than felony cases. Rather than give prosecutors unbridled discretion to allow any manufacturing case, we included the limitation that it could only come up in cases where the quantity involved is no more than described in the Medical Marijuana Act, and Mr. Stanford accurately communicated to you what those limitations are. The other two areas where the current law works injustice is in cases of minor violation of the Medical Marijuana Act, where a person is... You're allowed, as Mr. Stanford explained, 6 mature plants, which are defined as more than a foot tall or more than a foot wide or flowering, and 18 that are none of those things. So I've encountered cases where patients have, overnight the plant grew taller than it was supposed to, the police came by, they're charged with manufacturing, the total weight is considered, if it's a substantial quantity, which is defined as 5 ounces, then it's a level 8 offense, and the person's looking not only at a non-expungible felony, but a person with no prior record is looking at a presumptive 16 to 18 months in prison. So as to that class of people, it's appropriate that prosecutors have the discretion at issuing and judges have the discretion at sentencing to reduce it to misdemeanor. And the last class of people is the class of responsible adult personal use gardens, I guess, is the easiest explanation for it. People who aren't involved in any other criminal activity, but who aren't medical patients, but who use cannabis to relieve stress instead of alcohol, and rather than go out into the underground market to purchase, they cultivate for themselves. In some counties, certainly in the more urban metropolitan areas, these cases are handled differently than they are in the more rural areas, but the fact is that in some counties these cases are prosecuted and people are being convicted of these non-expungible felonies, and that's not just and it's not appropriate, and this proposal would change that. The Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association is certainly flexible on whether the best approach is to amend 161570 or 161705 or I think it's 137225 is the expunction statute, if I'm remembering right. We're certainly flexible about whether the discretion should be tied to the Medical Marijuana Act, whether it should be left open, whether it should be linked to substantial quantities. And I'd certainly entertain any questions that any of the committee members have. I did try to meet with several of you, and I apologize for not getting to meet with all of you. And for some, there were other intervening circumstances. So, but I'd be glad to answer any questions that anybody on the committee has about this.
Okay, so basically what you're trying to get at here is to make these crimes expungible rather than trying to, your secondary purpose might be to allow a lesser crime to be charged in the first place, but your main purpose in this bill is to give people a vehicle to expunge the crime for the crime that they actually committed.
Chair Burdick, the injustice that I first identified is the inability to expunge, but in trying to figure out how to approach that problem, there were these other system benefits that we realized if we were able to allow a reduction, both in the giving discretion to prosecutors and to judges, and in the positive fiscal impact of allowing this Class A felony to be prosecuted as a misdemeanor. I should note that the reason why it's a Class A felony is that it's marijuana continues to be erroneously classified both under the federal schedule and under the Oregon schedule as a Schedule 1 controlled substance. And because it's a Schedule 1, it's a Class A. It's an indeterminate 20 years. And as I indicated, it's a possession is a Level 1 offense unless it's aggravated to a Level 6 or 8 offense. And manufacturer's a level 4 offense unless it's aggravated to a level 8 offense.
Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. We also have Kevin Neely signed up here. Welcome to the committee.
Thanks. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kevin Neely on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. The Oregon District Attorneys Association opposes this bill. They oppose this bill because, again, this would be the first time that we had such a fundamental shift in the manufacture statutes. And for that reason, I apologize that there's not a deputy here. I'd expected one to be here, but I can report that they oppose this bill.
I guess I'm a little curious as to why you would oppose this, since it just gives discretion in an area where you don't have it now.
Madam Chair, I understand that this just gives us discretion. And again, what I can tell you is that this is an area in which the district attorneys don't feel that they need any discretion, that in fact, manufacturers shouldn't, there shouldn't be such discretion for the DAs. I wish I could give you more detail than that at this point. Unfortunately, I can't.
Having worked very hard on the meth package last session, I can't help but see a distinction between the definition of manufacturing, cooking up a chemical substance, which I think is what most people think of as manufacturing, and basically growing a plant, which is how marijuana is quote-unquote manufactured. Do you see any distinction there?
Chair Burdick, I think one of the things that Mr. Berger highlighted is that that they want some flexibility in the sentencings or in the prosecutions around those cases in which folks make mistakes around the state's medical marijuana law. Again, I think that the district attorney's view on this matter is that that if you're going to be a participant in the program, you have to vigorously adhere to the law. And if you fail to vigorously adhere to the law, then you're going to be subject to prosecution. That's the fact. In fact, of course, as you probably know.
Well, but this bill would apply to...
I understand that it applies broader than that. And that's, again, that's another concern that the district attorneys have. Under the terms of the state's medical marijuana law, and again, Mr. Berger and Mr. Stanford have already described to you the amounts that you're allowed to manufacture under that law, and it's not a small amount. It's a relatively significant
amount. Well, it's not a small amount, but this doesn't actually apply to the medical marijuana people. It applies to the other people who are not who don't have medical marijuana cards.
I understand.
These are people who have committed.
I understand that they're also. I understand, Madam Chair.
So, I guess the thing that perplexes me is the kind of the irony of having somebody plead guilty to a crime that they did not commit just to have it expungible later, and but getting into a situation where they have to plead to something they didn't commit when it's actually the same offense. And why the district attorneys would not welcome discretion to deal with that.
I understand, Madam Chair, and what I can tell you is that I'm perfectly happy to sit down and talk to the District Attorney's Association as to whether or not they'd be able to make any agenda. You'd be willing to look at the expungement statutes. Mm-hmm. That's not clear. We haven't had that discussion. What I can tell you is that right now, as this bill is written, the District Attorney's opposed the bill, and they oppose the bill because they feel that this would be the first time that we had a manufacturer statute that was treated in the manner in which this is treated.
Madam Chair.
Senator Krasinski.
I mean, the reality is, even if this bill went forward, there's nothing to require a district attorney or an ADA to actually take up that discretion. So it sounds to me, based on the opposition that the District Attorneys Association has, that maybe if the committee wants us to go forward as to giving the court some flexibility, there would be two ways to do it. One would be at the time of sentencing, the court could take into consideration based on whatever evidence came in at trial, and the court could modify or allow for some type of expungement. But again, I think it's going to be one of those case-by-case basis as to the circumstance and situation. I mean, it's interesting that we have had other cases that have come before us, situations, I should say, where the district attorney's office has wanted to have discretion, and I understand the frustration I hear from the chair as to why they wouldn't want that option, but clearly there's other ways of reaching it based on what the first witness has said as to allowing either the court to take that consideration at the time of sentencing and or at the time at some period of time in the future to allow an individual to seek to expunge the record. Then the court, I mean, we could set the policy as to what type of parameters that would be allowed in or not allowed in. I guess the point of it is, I'm not sure why go through the exercise and pass something that's not going to be used if they're that opposed to it.
There's something to be said for that. Well, maybe I think that I'd be interested in trying to resolve some of the issues that are in this bill, and so I would encourage the sponsors to work. Maybe you could all work together to try to at least make some kind of expungement necessary under possible under certain circumstances, because fact of the matter is, I mean, it's just plain different to grow a marijuana plant than it is to cook a bunch of meth. And I think our law should reflect that.
Fair enough, Madam Chair. We'd be more than happy to sit down with Mr. Berger. We've talked to him in the past about this issue. We'll see if we can get something back to you.
Keep trying. Thank you. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 327. And is there any other business for the committee? Close judiciary. Judiciary is adjourned. Thank you, committee. Go to them.